We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know. And sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. This show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Jonah Lanto.
Don Palumbo.
We are in studio today for the first time in years.
For the first time in actual years, recording a full episode of Midwest Murder. And it kind of got me thinking, Don, I like telling you stories, pal.
Yeah.
You're a good story listener.
I like to be a listener.
Yeah. A lot of times you tell stories out there and you tell a story to somebody and then they just move on with their life.
And I'm forced to listen to you. So that's also a thing too.
Yeah.
And you know, it's so different being in studio because there's nobody to laugh at my jokes.
No,
like,
I have to be the one to pity laugh.
This is going to be weird.
So as Don said, we're coming at you from the Midwest Murder Good Talk Studio in Minot. We've been working hard on memoirs for your lovely families and on our new TV show, Midwest Murder, True Crime Stories, which you can watch every Sunday night at 9 p.m. on Beck TV. It's on cable, or you can watch live using the Beck app. So we're also super grateful to all the support of our fans and listeners for helping us reach that milestone. And don't worry, Midwest Murder is still hosting live shows, and we do have tickets on sale for some of those live shows right now for our upcoming spring tour. We can't announce all of the dates right here, right now.
Our spring tour.
Did I just do that?
You did.
We can't wait to share an evening with you, but look forward to shows in Bismarck, Fargo, around North Dakota. And we're working on some South Dakota, Minnesota dates as well. So if you tune into our social medias, you can get the scoop on live shows coming to a town near you. And I have to point out, you know, we only do 20 some odd live shows a year.
Correct.
So it's actually not an overstatement or an exaggeration to say chances to join us for a live show are actually pretty rare.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've had to shift things around. We're not out there every week by any means. So yeah, come hang with us.
Yeah. Big thanks to everyone who's made it to a live show with us. And thank you everyone as well who has rated and reviewed Midwest Murder on iTunes or Spotify. Seriously, we are so grateful when you guys take the time to share your thoughts with us, good or bad. Don, I'm curious, what are people saying about Midwest Murder out there these days?
Yeah, it's super cool when you guys do take that time, because you taking that small time, even if you put one word in there, that helps us climb the charts. That's how they do that. So we appreciate that. Amy in Oklahoma gave us 5 stars. She's an Oklahoma fan. My auntie in Minot recommended this show when I visited in January, and this podcast has rapidly become a favorite of mine. The storytelling is top notch. You provide your references at the end of each episode, as anybody who, you know, with any journalistic integrity should. That was my own addition. And I love that your sponsors are local sponsors. I also love hearing the North Dakotan accent. Makes me feel like I'm home.
Hey, I don't have an accent. Don't you say that about me? Yeah,
don't you say that about that. I'll tell you what this is all about.
Thanks for that one,
thank
Oklahoma.
You so
we appreciate
thank
you down there.
Namsadaki, Namsadaki. I'm so sorry. Love my Midwest Murder Wheaties. Them gave us 5 stars. I enjoy lots of true crime podcasts, but also have to come back to my staple for down to earth, real talk about murders and humanity. Love your show and excited about the Beck venture. Can't wait to watch. Also can't wait until you come back to Bismarck so I can join you live. Guess what? We're coming back to Bismarck.
Coming back to Bismarck in April.
Yeah.
And it's in April. Tickets will be on sale very soon. Maybe even when you're hearing this.
I know. Yeah. So come say hi, please.
Yeah. Thanks for those reviews, folks. Please keep them coming. We just surpassed 700. We are marching toward 1,000, and we need your help to get there. So I think it's a milestone. We want to get that. By the end of the year, it'd be amazing to get 1,000. Maybe if we get like 1,000 reviews, we can do like a giveaway or something.
Something cool. Yeah.
We've also got some great merch. We've redesigned some graphics, added some new ones, and our merch is local. Please do. It's one of the most significant ways you can support the show is through our merch endeavor, and you can buy merch at www.toomanyshirts.com/Midwest-murder. The show is also brought to you in part by Midwest Memoirs, and let me break it down for you. This is all about capturing the stories of your family. Do you want to hear those stories forever? Like a podcast you can listen to with future generations, kids, grandkids, great grandkids, great great grandkids, stories that you can listen to 100 years from now from your ancestors, from your family, then you need to contact Midwest Memoirs because that is what we do. We're here to ensure those stories and the voices who tell them are never forgotten. It's like hiring professionals. Once in a while, Don and I, we can refer to ourselves as professionals.
In this instance, for sure.
For sure. So you hire professionals to conduct a 60 minutes like interview that is the story of your grandma's life or your grandpa or your uncle
or
your dad or yours. And this is, we do this chronologically, and that's what we're doing on Midwest Memoirs. And it's really special. And I sleep better at night knowing that my grandmother's stories will not be forgotten, that the grandchildren I'm in no hurry to have will someday know her voice and what she lived through hundreds of years before their time. Or just maybe like 100.
Yeah, and as someone who...
Like we're not mathing here.
Right, we still don't math, even on memoirs.
Even on memoirs.
And as someone who has recently lost, you know, their grandma and their dad without this, it would be super awesome to have this. Like, I get it the other way, right?
Absolutely. You can find Midwest Memoirs on Facebook and Instagram, and even like with everything, you know, these are limited availability slots. So do get a hold of us if you want that for your family. Today on Midwest Murder, we're heading back to 1965.
Ooh.
What was happening back in 65? Let me tell you, Don, on the Gemini 4 mission, astronaut Ed White became the first American to conduct a spacewalk. Heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali decimated challenger Sonny Liston about a minute into the first round. Days of Our Lives debuted on NBC. I think it's still going. I watched it with my mom growing up.
It is somehow still going.
The first U.S. combat troops arrive in Vietnam. By the end of the year, 190,000 American soldiers are in Vietnam. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and more than 2,600 others are arrested in Selma, Alabama during demonstrations against voter registration rules. Ugh. Unarmed marchers were beaten mercilessly with billy clubs. I think it's called Bloody Sunday.
Bloody Sunday. Yeah, and if you get a chance to watch that movie, you really, really should. In fact, we should watch it yearly.
Later that same month, Malcolm X was shot to death in Harlem, assassinated, some would say. These events helped usher in the Voting Rights Act, guaranteeing Black American citizens the right to vote by law. The Sound of Music premiered. It's still revered as one of the greatest musical films of all time. I've never watched it.
Oh, The Hills Are Alive with The Sound of Music.
Of course they are.
You don't know what that is because you've never seen it.
So I mean, I'm familiar. I know that. You told me that, I knew that was from there.
I'm done talking to you about it.
Yeah. Race riots also broke out in Watts, California, leaving large parts of the city burnt and looted and 34 dead.
Oh, the 1960s.
Tough times.
Hopefully we know better now and can do better.
I think we're doing a little better.
I hope so.
I think progress has occurred. So there's a statement, Don. We've all heard it. It was a robbery gone wrong. It's a phrase I think I've heard or read hundreds of times, and I feel like we all kind of know what it means, but I've also learned it's never safe to assume everyone just knows something. Don, what's your first thought when you hear robbery gone wrong?
You shouldn't be doing it in the first place. It reminds me of the line from Liar Liar when Jim Carrey goes, "Stop breaking the law, asshole." That's what it reminds me of. Like, you shouldn't even be there to make it go wrong.
Fair.
That's my first thought.
Fair. My first thought is someone died is usually what it means.
Oh, well, that too, I suppose. Yeah.
So, but I also couldn't help but consider the phrasing because to me, robbery gone wrong implies there's such a thing as a robbery gone right.
Thank you. See, there we go. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So both are in there. But I think for the most part, you have robbery gone wrong. Oh, somebody died or got hurt. So what is a robbery gone right? Is that just any robbery that goes according to some dipshit criminal's plan and where nobody gets hurt or murdered? Is that how you would describe a robbery gone right, air quotes?
Hot dog, I committed a felony.
Right?
Ooh, yeah.
Realistically, for most of us who are somewhat normal, law-abiding citizens, there's just no such thing as a robbery gone right. There are, however, some robberies that go exactly according to their wicked design.
Oh dear, that sounds sinister.
Robberies planned not just with the intent to steal, but also to murder. Maybe just to murder. In today's case, robbery was likely the secondary objective of a man who could not resist a terrible compulsion to kill. Stories, books, and movies have weaved a lot of romanticism around outlaw personas, many of whom rob banks. In most cases, robbers never intend to kill anyone. They just want to steal federally insured money at gunpoint, pack into their getaway car, and retire to an island nation with no extradition treaty because, obviously, bank robbers are well-organized and connected criminals executing meticulously thought-out schemes.
Hey,
right?
I mean, bank robbers, right? You have to be. There have been some heists. I think that's
There've been extremely well-organized heists.
I think that's what it is. When a robbery goes right, they call them a heist.
Oh.
That is not correct.
Well, according to data from the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, most of these stereotypes could not be more wrong. Nearly 80% of bank robberies are committed not by organized team of professionals, but by a solitary offender with no prior convictions. And nearly 3/4 of robberies are unarmed offenders who do not use a weapon or threaten violence.
You know what I take from that? I take from that 20% are committed that way.
There you go.
Are committed,
of course,
successfully.
In fact, the person most often killed in the commission of a bank robbery is the robber. And even that is rare. And this last bit is interesting too. Only about 60% of bank robberies are solved. Now, I'm not a gambling man, Don, but even I know 60-40 odds, pretty decent. Pair those odds with the fact that 80% of the stolen money is never recovered, and you might be able to see what can entice a criminal mind toward bank robbery, even though the average haul, according to the FBI, only ranges between $8,000 and $10,000. It's not a lot.
It seems much ado about nothing. Not that $10,000 isn't a lot of money. It is, but...
Get this. Many of these guys who are busted for bank robbery said they would have been happy with less.
Oh.
So, it's weird.
Oh, interesting.
In the 1930s, bank robbery became a craze, and citizens were somewhat sympathetic to these outlaws because banks and financial institutions were being blamed for economic depression. It peaked with a string of violent confrontations that included well-known names like John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde.
But that's entitlement. That's entitlement.
I don't disagree. Following that cycle of violence, things settled down for a time as banks implemented a combination of enhanced security features as well as employee training with pretty strict practices of compliance when confronted by a robber. Frankly, there's no amount of money in those vaults that is worth anyone's lives, and financial institutions made it clear they were not expecting employees to take risks. Compliance practices, along with a massive expansion of bank branches, which led to standardized designs, predictable layouts, and predictable operations, preceded a massive increase in bank robberies between 1965 and 1975, when the number quadrupled from 847 to 3,517.
Okay.
It's on that note that we find our story arriving in the sleepy Great Plains town of Big Springs, Nebraska, where farming, football, and church give people a reason to make little trips down the gravel road from their lonesome farmhouses. It's June 4th, 1965, a bloody, fateful Friday, the day when most bank robberies are likely to occur.
Fridays?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
A day of infamy, marred by the bloodiest bank robbery of the era, perpetrated by a likable hometown hero. To 77-year-old Andy Keldgaard, June 4th should have been just another day at the office, serving his community as president of Farmer State Bank, where he and brother Carl had been owners since 1927. As first-generation Danish immigrants, the brothers represented an American dream, arriving with hope and a will to work. They built up a considerable wheat farm and cattle ranch over the years, which eventually allowed them the opportunity to buy Farmer State Bank. Andy ran the bank operations. His brother Carl and Carl's son Wayne ran the farm. Although Andy Keldgaard was openly known to be, quote, a little hard-nosed about a loan, he had an unadvertised soft spot for people with hard luck stories or kids starting off in college. Big Springs was very much an Old West sort of place. A sign just on the outskirts of town read, quote, warning, Swedes on their way to town have the right of way.
Okay.
And with only 510 citizens, Farmer State Bank in Big Springs didn't require too many employees. Also present at Farmer State Bank on Friday, June 4th, were 60-year-old Glenn Hendrickson, who worked there as a cashier since it first opened almost 40 years prior, 35-year-old bank teller Lois Ann Hoffen, a recently widowed mother of two, and 25-year-old Franklin Keldgaard, Andy's nephew, who filled in the gaps, functioning as Andy's right-hand man. At around 11:30 a.m. that morning, a tall, well-dressed man in a dark suit, white shirt, and striped tie walked into the single-story brick bank on the corner carrying a briefcase. There were no other customers inside. Andy greeted the man and offered help, not knowing it was the final time he'd ever greet a customer. The suit-wearing stranger asked about a land development loan. Andy told him Farmer State Bank doesn't handle those types of loans, and he helpfully offered to get him the number to the Ogallala Bank. As Andy motioned to grab a phone book, the tall stranger calmly walked around the employee counter, pulled a pistol from his briefcase, and demanded Andy put the money inside. The weapon appeared to have some kind of iron pipe extension attached to the barrel, a homemade silencer. It all happened so fast. Frank Keldgaard came to his uncle's side right away, offering assistance and assurance. Together, Andy and Frank filled the briefcase with money from the cash drawer. Lois Ann Hoffen was then commanded to get the money from the vault. Terrified, she entered the vault and returned moments later with just handfuls of dollars of bills, telling the gunman she couldn't open the vault. Why not? He demanded. Through tears, Lois quickly stammered that the vault was on a time lock and could not be opened. Don't play games with me, lady, he shouted back. Then something changed. A dreadful sense filled the room as the sharp-dressed stranger finally took notice of Glenn Hendrickson, who had been quietly sitting at a side table while all this was happening. That's when the four employees of Farmer State Bank were ordered at gunpoint to lie face down on the floor. As per standard practice and training, all four complied with the order, hoping for this terrible moment to be over. If only they had known this particular bank robber, wearing no disguise, never intended on leaving any witnesses. In fact, killing was a far stronger motivation to him than robbery. He calmly proceeded to execute them one by one.
Oh, gosh.
First was Andy. Pressing the gun against Andy's back, the gunman fired a single shot through the bank president's heart. The gun jammed, stalling the bloodbath, if only for a moment. Franklin Keldgaard was shot next. Once in the back, gun pressed against his shirt. Within seconds, Lois Hoffen and Glenn Hendrickson had each been shot once in the back as well. The bodies jerked when shot. Blood poured out smoothly. When Pope noticed they were still moving and moaning, he finished each with another bullet to the back of the head. The slug that took Andy passed through his neck from right to left, exiting below the left ear. The second bullet ripped into Glenn Hendrickson through the back of his mouth, exiting the right side of his face and shattering the jawbone. He stopped moving instantly. Lois Hoffen would have survived the first bullet, which missed her aorta, but the second shot severed blood vessels, ruptured the tongue, and smashed her teeth, which splintered from her mouth onto the floor. She lost consciousness from pain and shock, but the cause of death was blood which filled Lois's lungs, drowning her.
Thank goodness she just lost consciousness. That's awful. Ugh.
The killer nonchalantly made his way out of Farmer State Bank with $1,598 in cash, leaving four bleeding victims on the floor behind the counter. As he walked out of the bank, he bumped into local farmer and customer Otto Mauser, politely saying, "Good morning," or "How do you do?" while making his exit. Mauser walked into the bank, not immediately noticing anything unusual, but as he began writing his check at a desk, the silence in the bank became eerie. Otto Mauser called out. When there was no response, he wandered around just enough to see Lois Hoffman lying on the floor, toes awkwardly pointing at each other, her high heels poking outward. Just above the waist of her white dress, he saw a dark red circle. Mauser ran from the bank, yelling for help.
That's like $15,000 in 2024.
That's not...
$15,000. But that wasn't a motivation for him, what you said. I mean, it was, you know, ending lives was more...
Yeah, and we'll get into that.
Oh my gosh.
Seconds later, after Mauser ran from the bank, the burglar alarm at Farmer State Bank sounded off, ringing loud enough to alert all 510 Big Springs citizens. It was none other than Franklin Keldgaard, who miraculously survived the slaughter and somehow managed to drag his bleeding, partially paralyzed body across the floor to press the alarm, which was under the counter. Franklin was left for dead, but the first bullet came within a fraction of an inch of his spinal column, paralyzing him. And the first shot missed his heart. The second shot missed his spinal column. Severely injured, he heard everything following the attempt on his life. And he was second shot. This moment instantly became the bloodiest and most violent bank robbery of the era. And a killer who left no shortage of clues or witnesses behind in spite of his terrible efforts was now on the loose.
Wow. That's a lot.
That was hard. Yeah, it's hard to get through that. It's hard to understand how somebody could come in there and do that. And the surprise of Franklin.
That he lived?
Yeah. At least six witnesses saw a tall man speeding throughout Big Springs in a green car with no license plates before finally heading north on US 138. Don, this guy got lost during his escape. He even had to turn around at a dead end.
So he walks in there all nonchalantly. I mean, has this whole plan that goes seemingly well, I guess, if you're him, but then gets lost.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah.
He took what many would call a very circuitous route. Wow. Fleeing town.
Never even heard that word, but okay.
Within minutes, a local posse armed with rifles and shotguns came together and spread out to search barns, vacant buildings, anywhere the killer might be hiding. And there was one resounding attitude among them. Let's get this son of a bitch. They were fired up.
It's such a 1960s. It's just an old world thing. Old, yeah. I shouldn't say old world. Like we're talking coming from Italy or something like that. Like, you know, coming through Ellis Island, but a local posse armed with rifles and shotguns. Right.
Yeah. Like checking out buildings,
some vigilante shit there. Like seriously. It's just, that's not, that would just never happen.
No.
In today's world.
No, not likely. Yeah. At least not in the city. Maybe out on some more remote type of areas.
And it'd be quietly.
Yeah.
It certainly wouldn't be published.
Authorities were alerted quickly. Roadblocks were set up on major thoroughfares, but the killer was already traveling country roads. Law enforcement mustered a rapid aerial response with two planes from Big Springs and three more from Imperium, Nebraska to the south. But as the planes converged on the region, so too did heavy storm clouds and a deluge of rain, forcing the planes to turn around and helping a mass murderer elude capture. It ended up raining 6 inches.
Oh my gosh.
The manhunt was on, and it didn't take long for federal authorities to follow the amateur trail of the killer and identify their target. Piece by piece, starting with descriptions from Otto Mauser and Franklin Keldgaard and several others who quite obviously noted the well-dressed businessman driving through their sleepy little town, once that description and vehicle were circulated, the FBI was able to track the car the very next day, a light green two-door 1965 Chevy Impala, to a Hertz rental agency in Salina, Kansas, 6 hours to the south.
And that two-door Chevy Impala was like the size of a limousine today.
Yeah,
it was a boat.
A noticeable car. Yeah. Nice car, too. The Impala was abandoned at the agency in the middle of the night, dented and covered in mud with gas leaking from the fuel tank. That Impala was rented on the morning of June 3rd and signed for by a gangly young man with a long face and a gold tooth by the name of Dwayne Pope. The vehicle and its gold-toothed, long-armed driver was then linked to a motel in Ogallala, 20 minutes outside of Big Springs, that same night. The man checked in under the same name, Dwayne Pope.
Now, this guy, his motive was not student loans like ours would be today. I mean, in 1965,
That's a good question. What was his motive?
What was his motive?
Well, we'll get into that. There's a lot of controversy over his motive.
Okay.
Now, you might think that a person who concocted a plan, which included bank robbery and homicide, wouldn't be dumb enough to use their real name. Well, think again. Dwayne Earl Pope wasn't just anybody. He was a well-known, well-liked, all-American high school and college football player who has just graduated college the week prior. When news broke that Dwayne Pope was wanted for murder and robbery, there was a very common reaction throughout the region where Pope was known and raised. That's not our Dwayne. That's a different Dwayne Pope. Many outright refused to believe it. The story swept the region and eventually the nation. As the days went on with no sign of Pope, the FBI set off to learn more about the killer. Classmates, teachers, friends, and family, clergy, anyone who knew Dwayne Pope was grilled by the FBI. They also learned Pope left $150 in his father's mailbox, $50 to pay back a loan he got from his dad to rent the car, and another $100 for his dad to deposit in his account. No one in the family saw him do this in the middle of the night. Dwayne Earl Pope was one of eight kids. He came from Roxbury, a little speck of a town in McPherson County, Kansas. Pope's father, Earl, unsuccessfully rented a farm and ran a junk business on the side. Dwayne Pope's father, Earl, was a big, boisterous, and mean taskmaster. He wasn't kind to the farm animals, and his punishments were stern, oftentimes unjust, although most won't quite go so far as to say he was abusive. Seems pretty borderline. The Pope family was widely known as one of the most poor in the area. Their stuff was always broken down. Their property was a hoarderville. Their crops were often really half-assed.
If in 1965 they're hesitant to say abusive, they're like, it's on the border in 65. That shit was downright abusive. Like that
there
was,
you go.
I mean, that was a violent home.
That's probably a very fair assessment. It was just Pope never said his dad beat him, you know, but he got it with the switch and it was bad. And again, oftentimes seemed unbalanced and unfair how punishment was doled out. So they didn't exactly have a lot growing up, but Pope was a hard worker, a little on the shy or quiet side, but kind, likable. And he never got into trouble. Never. He was on the student council for several years. He was senior class president. Quote, if I had a classroom full of boys like Dwayne Pope, teaching would be a pure joy, said one of his former teachers. His prowess in the football field, where he played efficiently on both sides of the ball, earned Pope an athletic scholarship to McPherson College, becoming the first in his family to attend an institution of higher learning. He didn't really want to go to college, but was more or less strong-armed into it by his family and everybody else he knew. At McPherson, Pope majored in the industrial arts. He was an average student and an outstanding football player, elected by his teammates as co-captain and named to the All-Kansas Conference as a senior. He even played clarinet in the school band. Pope stayed busy working as a janitor during the school year and on a custom combine crew throughout the summer. His combine crew traveled all the way as far north as Canada, sure. all throughout mm-hmm. the Midwest and as far north as Canada. He was the kind of guy everyone seemed to like, always smiling, too nice for his own good, some would say. The type of person to capture a spider inside and let it free. Or play soft in football practice against smaller opponents, something his coaches often had to get on his case about, not practicing as hard as he could against smaller people. Dwayne Pope was such a rule follower, he once refused to wear a stolen practice jersey offered to him by his best friend and roommate, Nick Petrucci, who said, quote, "He was a great guy, one of the greatest guys I will ever know." He was remembered as the kind of athlete who always helped other players up, even those from the opposing team. He never argued or protested bad calls by refs or got mad during games. Whereas his father once stormed the basketball court and pressed a referee against the wall by his throat after the ref called what Earl believed to be a very lopsided contest, which ended a season-long winning streak for Dwayne's team. Dwayne was often very embarrassed by these public displays of his parents. They argued in public. They did stuff like this was not uncommon, and it was very, very, very embarrassing for Dwayne.
If that's how his father is acting in public, imagine how he's acting behind closed doors.
Yes. No one could ever recall seeing Dwayne Pope angry, but when pressed to consider it more deeply, not many people could remember Pope displaying deep emotions about anything other than Caterpillar tractors. And he rarely dated. Although several girls had shown interest over the years, for the most part, Pope would clam up, turn red, and go quiet anytime a girl spoke to him. After high school, he eventually overcame that to some degree, developing a friendly relationship with a woman by the name of Ramona Lowe. But Pope was not fully invested. And in their time together, Ramona said he seemed more interested in Caterpillar tractor machines than he did her. Time and again, when Pope seemed to get close with a woman, he cut them off. At 22 years old, Pope had just graduated with a bachelor's degree in the week before the tragedy at Big Springs. He had also recently purchased a .22 automatic Ruger pistol. Following graduation, Pope told Ramona he planned to work around McPherson. He told his older brother he didn't know what he was going to do. In fact, Pope was viewed as directionless by the few women who dated him, like the kind of person who was going through the motions because it's what normal human people are supposed to do, not because it's something he wanted to do. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Pope owned an old car, a 1939 Buick convertible, several Caterpillar tractors, and he had about $1,000 in bank loan debts. Pope's banker called him financially responsible with no credit concerns or trouble, had never missed a payment. On Wednesday, just 2 days before the incident, Pope borrowed $50 from his dad and said he was going to Oklahoma to look for work, any kind of work. It was the last time Earl, Dwayne's father, had seen his son before the murders. A gas station attendant in Wanita, Kansas, reported Pope stopped there for gas, attempted to plug a hole in the gas tank with a rag, and then tried to pay with an expired credit card. When the attendant also refused Pope's check, Pope left a false address and drove off. Minutes later, the attendant and his coworker realized Pope was wanted after hearing his description on the radio. And that was, of course, the day he fled the robbery. Authorities had some idea of the route taken by Pope, but the rain severely hampered countryside search efforts and kept the aerial searches grounded. As I said, it ultimately rained more than 6 inches. The FBI did track his whereabouts to the Log Cabin Motel in Salina, Kansas. That was the same town where Pope rented the Impala from Hertz. And the search for answers was intense, but days went by with no sign of Dwayne Pope. A nationwide FBI alert went out on Monday, June 7th. Pope was referred to as, quote, "very dangerous and probably armed" by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover.
I have, you know, my apologies for interrupting on something
ahead.
That's somewhat unrelated. Anytime I hear anything about J. Edgar Hoover, I just brush it off because I don't trust a word that came out of that guy's mouth. I mean, I act like you know, he called me at home and told me stories, but I would love to do just an episode on his shenanigans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, so
The doll probably has a good one about him.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, cool. J. Edgar Hoover didn't like him. Okay. Neat. No, his story speaks for himself. However,
it does.
That's just one of my little tangents. Okay.
Hoover tangent. Explore that with Dawn at a future show. Should you encounter her?
Yeah. Yeah. Please don't bring it up.
Law enforcement believed Pope to be driving his 1939 black Buick convertible with a white top. Pictures of Pope and the vehicle landed on the front page of nearly every newspaper in the region. Funeral services were held for the slain victims just 3 blocks from where their lives were taken. An overwhelmingly sad day for the tight-knit community of Big Springs. Lois Hoffman's service made up the largest floral display the church had ever seen.
There's, you know, it's a very small town, a little over 500 people.
Yep.
And 4 well-liked people, just innocent, or 3, I should say, sorry, 3 at this point.
Yep. 3.
3. That's
it's devastating.
That's devastating. Yeah.
And these were, I don't know, these were people who were loved, well-liked. Lois, I mean, it was she just lost her husband suddenly.
Ugh.
Big Springs Methodist Church seats 250. They added another 250 chairs in the basement and 100 chairs in a new educational wing, and they set speakers up on the outside for additional overflow.
I can't imagine there...
Not an empty seat in the house.
Yeah. Ugh.
Andy Kjeldgaard was a lifelong bachelor who loved fishing, fly fishing in particular. Glenn Hendrickson, hardworking but not ambitious. He enjoyed the easy, habitual pace of his life. Coffee, breakfast, conversation with his wife in the daily paper. Coached his son's little league team. And Lois Hoffman, she was a tiny 5'3" country doll who married her high school sweetheart. Ugh. They were a beautiful, hardworking couple, and they had the most unique house in town, and everybody loved them. A lot of people would ask this, so I made sure to include the children of Lois Hoffman were taken in by her brother, Kenneth.
Okay, that was one of my questions.
Later that day, I like how I say a lot of people are going to ask this, like we're at a show, because I just know that would have been like one of the audience questions.
That would have been one of the questions.
What happened to her kids? Later that day, June 7th, a mentally impaired employee working at the Wichita Eagle noticed the Buick convertible sitting in a Wichita alley. This is just 50 miles down the road from McPherson, where the FBI was set up for this whole ordeal. So this vehicle was missed by the FBI and Wichita police. And it was actually a pretty big deal that this impaired individual was the one who identified the vehicle when police and FBI people missed it. Inside, police found a college class schedule, a 30-30 rifle, but no sign or evidence of where Dwayne Pope might be. 6 days after the killings, Dwayne Pope is officially on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list. A statement from McPherson College President Desmond Bittinger is circulated, quote, "We would like you to know that we, your friends at McPherson, both faculty and students, continue to be your friends," Bittinger said in an Associated Press statement. Quote, "We suggest and urge that you give yourself up to the proper police authorities at once."
Wow.
Very controversial for him to do that.
Yeah.
When Dwayne Pope sees the plea from Bittinger, along with the news that he's one of the most wanted men in America, it breaks his will to stay on the run. Pope contacts his old mentor from a Kansas City hotel, asks what he should do, and Bittinger urges Pope to turn himself into police. Pope is arrested that night without issue, and he willingly confesses to his crimes afterward, including a long written statement of how he planned it, where he went following the murders. He ended up confessing twice after waiving his rights, once in a 6-page confession and again in a 19-page confession that was a little more detailed. While fleeing, Dwayne heard the radio announcements calling out the news of his heinous deed. Sticking to country roads, Dwayne went back to the motel in Salina before acquiring his Buick, which was parked on a side street not far from the Hertz agency. Pope dropped the rental off at 2 a.m., hopped in the Buick, which was parked on a nearby side street, left the money in his parents' mailbox, then drove to Wichita. In Wichita, he ditched his vehicle, was traveling with the cash and a loaded Derringer pistol. He boarded a bus heading for Enid, Oklahoma, then another bus to Oklahoma City, where he bought a plane ticket to El Paso. Once in El Paso, Pope purchased a bus ticket for San Diego. He said he felt anonymous and safe on the bus. After arriving in San Diego, Pope wrapped most of the money in a newspaper he pulled from the garbage, stuffed the money and the Derringer pistol in a locker, and with $100 in his wallet, Pope held a cab for Tijuana and went to a bullfight. The aimlessness of his life didn't stop.
This is all within the 6 days.
Yep. This is him breaking down his 6 days of what he was doing. Aimlessly wandering the streets of Tijuana for a time, he eventually crossed back over to the United States, picking up the money from the locker and checking into a cheap hotel. I guess the body count and briefcase full of cash didn't really do much to give direction to Dwayne Pope. Still lost and confused, Pope bought a used car for $400 in cash, but the engine blew up just miles from town. He mulled around a hotel before buying a bus ticket to Las Vegas, where he spent the first day winning on slots and the second day losing his ass off at blackjack, literally having no idea how to play the game. Like, he was hitting 18s and stuff like that. Like, just no idea what he was doing. Pope saw the story and plea from his old president, and he had a complete emotional breakdown, realizing his life was completely ruined and over. Pope then flew from Vegas to Denver, then to Kansas City. And Pope carried with him the Derringer pistol through all these places.
What a different time.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. All the bus driving and flying that he's done, Derringer pistol the whole time. After arriving in Kansas City, Pope checked into a hotel, took the gun from his briefcase, held it to his temple, put his finger on the trigger. But upon looking up and seeing his own reflection holding the gun, Pope couldn't do it. That's about when Dwayne Pope called the Kansas City dispatch and said, quote, "I want to give myself up. I understand I'm wanted for robbery in Big Springs, Nebraska." The date of his arrest was June 11th. The trial began in November of 1965. There was enough hard evidence to convict Pope without using either of his two confessions. That he committed this act was not in question. Even without Dwayne Pope's confession, prosecutors had every piece of evidence they need to convict him with ease. That aspect of this trial was never in doubt, but they would have to prove Pope wasn't a crazed schizophrenic who had no control over his own actions. The defense moved for an insanity plea. To find the thrown silencer and .22 Ruger, searchers estimated the distance Pope could throw the items based on his javelin and discus throws from track. Both the
I don't know why that's funny to me.
It's great.
They're checking his stats and being like, "Oh, it's actually pretty smart." I mean,
it's very good. Yeah, yeah. It really was smart. And the director of the searches had his people fan out very specifically, and they searched along the route where Pope took, and they found the items in the fields. The investigation also learned that Pope, during his time spent in the region while combining, had made inquiries into a prior bank robbery at Big Springs, not to mention all the countless witnesses who saw him in town and saw him flee. The question really was whether or not Pope was in control of his actions at the time of the murders. Prosecutors were seeking the death penalty. Defense attorneys sought to prove Dwayne Pope was insane. Since the defense entered an insanity plea, Pope underwent numerous psychiatric evaluations before the trial, obviously to see if he was stand fit, of course, which he was, but also just to learn more about whether or not this man is insane. Although these interviews revealed a person who was clearly tormented and very likely mentally ill, insanity was highly debatable. A number of additional details emerged during the trial, not just of Pope's psyche, but also related to his work-life relationships and preparations he made for the robbery. Throughout his life, Dwayne Pope had many strange dreams of being shot and killed and bleeding, but every time in the dream, he just laughed at the shooter. He had visions, even urges, to drown his younger brother and to shoot his older brother. These were urges he actively fought down when they came up. The closer he got to graduation, the more intensely visions of murder beat through Dwayne Pope's mind like a drum, a constant pounding rhythm that became part of him. Over and over, he saw himself shooting people and standing over them with a gun. Dwayne dealt with intense, sometimes overwhelming feelings of inadequacy, not feeling as if he belonged, worried others were talking about him behind his back. Jokes from his friends actually stung him, but Dwayne was too polite to speak up. Insecure over his big nose and long jaw, as well as his intellectual shortcomings, there were signs Dwayne was teased for working as a janitor to pay his room and board to college. He was often referred to as the Hick. The combination of Dwayne's kindness, patience, and athletic talents made Dwayne a great candidate to be a teacher or coach. Friends, teachers, and the few girls he dated often pressured him to pursue a career in teaching, but the prospect terrified Dwayne Pope. He didn't even want to go to college, let alone be a teacher. All he wanted to do was work on Caterpillar tractors and farm. Dwayne dated Ramona while at college. He once told her he had dreams of shooting people he felt he had offended him. Every summer, Dwayne Pope worked on a custom combine crew. He made a nice chunk of money, anywhere from $700 to $900 a summer. And every summer, he talked about not going back to college. His friends and coworkers always talked him out of quitting, pressured him back into going. He once considered joining the Navy after his junior year. He was talked out of that. By then, he owned two mostly functioning Caterpillar tractors, but he had no truck or trailer to transport either. He often mentioned wanting to work on farms with them, excavating, digging ponds, removing trees, but he had no real plan. He was just obsessed with caterpillars. Everyone he met seemed interested in his post-graduation plans, and every time Dwayne Pope seemed aimless. He continued struggling to maintain healthy relationships with women, and the vision of shooting people became a regular, intrusive thought. In the months preceding graduation, Dwayne Pope built the silencer in shop class at school and back at his family farm. It took him three separate efforts to fabricate this and get it working efficiently the way he wanted to. He also fashioned a breastplate from an old bulldozer blade, which he wore the day of the robbery. So he had armor on underneath his suit. Now, he was caught building the silencer, that device, but his teacher simply assumed Dwayne was fabricating something for one of his Caterpillar machines. And that's what Dwayne said, and that's what everybody believed. During the week between between graduating and the robbery.
So he was planning this.
He was.
Essentially.
He was planning it, and it was open. The fact that he was planning it was very open. It was very obvious.
And maybe not planning it like at the space, you know, but he was just ready.
There was a part of his mind that was certainly wanted to, felt compelled to fulfill this vision that he was having.
Yeah.
So during the week between graduation and robbery, Pope hung out mostly with his older brother. They spent one day driving all the way to the Colorado border just to look at an old tractor for a few minutes and then drive back. During that time, they also stopped in Salina, and Pope scoped out the rental agency and made the arrangements to rent the Impala during that drive in front of his brother. And his brother's like, well, what do you need that for? He's like, well, I'm just going to rent a vehicle, and that's the one I'm going to take to Oklahoma when I get to work. And his brother was like, well, why do you need to do that? And Dwayne gave kind of a nonchalant answer and didn't really press him for it. So Dwayne was doing some of these things out in the open.
Just in plain sight.
Just in plain sight. Some would believe maybe because he wanted to get caught before he did what he was going to do. So when Dwayne left home the week of the murders, his family believed him to be traveling to Oklahoma for work. Apparently, now this is where it's so weird. The day Dwayne Pope picked up the rental vehicle, the physical license he had and showed was expired, but Pope insisted he turned the paperwork in. A very helpful employee from the rental agency drove him to the local highway patrol office, but it was closed. So the manager at Hertz Rental called the larger office in Topeka, Kansas, and verified Pope's license was actually active. So he rented him the car, but Pope would have to fill out a new form before his new ID could be reissued. Get this. Pope went and did that paperwork on June 3rd before heading up to his hotel in Ogallala. Don, the day before his plan to kill people, he went and did paperwork so that he could get his license reissued. How the hell do you make sense of that?
Well, he didn't want to get caught on something as simple as a expired license. I mean, he used his own name, so maybe not. Maybe that's not accurate either. But
I don't think
so. But he was always a rule follower.
Yeah, something in his. I don't think he understood the severity of what he was planning fully, or to some degree.
And like, maybe just didn't understand, or just didn't believe the magnitude
that his life was going to be over when he did this.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Did not believe his life was going to be over, or maybe even believed somehow something would stop him before that happened. But it's just one of those things. It always really twists my mind a little bit.
The moments leading up, like what did they plan for?
And the defense in trial brought on a cavalcade of witnesses who sang the praises of the Duane Pope they knew, loved, and grew up with. Teachers, coaches, clergy, friends, girls he spent time with. Not one person had a single negative thing to say about the man they knew. When Duane Pope took the stand, I gotta say his answers were really frustrating and wishy-washy and confusing, and frankly just felt like total bullshit to me when I was reading them. It was irritating. Pope spent 4 days on the stand. After testifying to the defense that he had no interest in money, Pope couldn't later explain to prosecutors why he went into the bank and demanded money be put in the briefcase. Now, this is just one example of the wishy-washiness of Pope's answers that I'll give you from the trial. Quote, "Why did you direct Lois Hothan to go into the vault?" "I don't know. I just told her to go in there and get some money," Pope murmured back. "You didn't want any more money, but you told her to go and get it anyway. Is that right?" "I didn't care about the money." "You didn't care about the money, but you told her to go and get it." "Yes." "Well, now explain why. You're the only one who knows." "I'm not sure that I know." "You don't know why you didn't care about the money and still wanted more. Is that what you are telling the ladies and gentlemen of the jury?" "I don't really know," replied Pope. So a lot of it went like that with him. And he mumbled and spoke very quietly the whole time. He actually got scolded by the judge several times for not speaking loudly enough and murmuring and kind of talking under his voice like that.
I don't know if he did know. I don't think he actually knew.
I don't think he did either.
It was almost like he was in a trance or something. I mean, not saying, you know, that.
Of course you're not saying that.
No, I mean, but I don't think psychologically or mentally, whatever word you want to use, I don't think he knew or understood.
In all of his interactions with the psychiatrists, Pope yearned for that understanding in his discussions with them.
Yeah.
Pope also testified to the defense that he wanted to get caught. He hoped somebody would stop him or discover what he was planning and prevent it. But then also couldn't explain why he lied to his dad and teacher about fabricating the silencer, or why he hid on country back roads during the getaway.
I think this is what would be classified today as borderline personality disorder of some sort, because that's me not being someone who can diagnose people. That's just my understanding of it.
Oh, wait, we'll get into it. Save those thoughts too.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Save those.
Okay.
That's good stuff, Don.
Okay.
And I don't disagree with that at all. Pope failed to understand what compelled him to murder, and during his conversations with psychiatrists, looked to them for understanding. Depending on whose expert psychiatric opinion you subscribe to at trial, Pope was schizophrenic, or not quite, but he did have schizoid tendencies, dissociative traits, episodes of psychosis, and was not in control of his own actions at the time of the killings, or he was none of the above. He was simply quiet and introverted, but most certainly not insane. 8 experts in the field of psychology testified, 5 for the prosecution and 3 for the defense. Ultimately, the majority of psychiatrists agreed in favor of the prosecution. Duane was not insane, but his mind was haunted by hostile feelings toward his parents and twisted by feelings of inadequacy. But there was no question he knew right from wrong. And killing three people in the commission of a robbery was not an insane, uncontrollable impulse. The experts preceded the final witness, Franklin Keldgaard, whose emotional testimony left a lifelong imprint on those in the courtroom. In the end, jurors did not accept the insanity plea. Dwayne Pope was found guilty and later sentenced to death. Pope was scheduled to die by electrocution three separate times, twice in 1970 and a third time in 1971. But a combination of ongoing appeals saved his life when on January 5th, 1973, the death penalty was outlawed.
Federally,
mm-hmm. Correct, yes. Numerous appeals eventually helped Dwayne get his sentence commuted to four consecutive life sentences. While prosecutors and even many of the police involved with this case would have us believe Pope's motive was simply a financial comeuppance, a means to an end for him to start an excavating business and impress a woman, the truth is far more complex than that. To many, Dwayne was simply written off as a young man gone wrong. Pope, a ruthless killer of three good people, didn't deserve any attention or understanding beyond that. To question otherwise invited considerable scrutiny, even hatred. Desmond Bidinger received hate mail for his plea letter.
Of wanting him to turn himself in?
And saying that we, your friends, still support you.
Oh, gosh.
Bidinger was also led to believe that if he encouraged Dwayne to come home, Dwayne would be able to get psychiatric help. That was a key thing, and even the defense fought for that. He was not ever given any psychiatric help. And get this, McPherson University, which is a religious university, actually faced public accusations of radicalizing Pope into becoming a murderer. Nor was there much tolerance for Pope's parents, who were booed and jeered and shouted and screamed at every day entering the courtroom. I can't imagine what that was like for them.
But yeah, they still showed up. I mean,
they did. They showed up
to support their son. Did they agree with what he did? Likely not.
No. And they raised eight kids. Seven of them weren't killers. Something happened here, you know.
Right. So
trying to understand Pope's breakdown, we'll go into it a little bit here. It's complicated. Pope held a lifelong obsession for Caterpillar tractors and guns, objects his mind perceived as strong, stable, powerful. In contrast, Dwayne Pope bent to the will of others, how they wanted him to be, what they wanted him to be. He was always compliant, never quite feeling in control of his life. Internally, never feeling worthy, full of self-doubt. The combination of nature and nurture in Dwayne's life left him emotionally stunted and unable to deeply express or process the complicated gamut of profound human emotions. His parents weren't monsters. They were just overworked people with deep flaws who never made it out of poverty and had way too many kids. Punishments in his house were unjust and harsh. Love was sparing. Belittling was abundant.
And his dad was abusive, it seems like.
Not like punching his kid. He was never beaten.
He was taking his frustrations out of the world and the cards that he were dealt or was dealt but onto his kids.
Punishment was harsh, yeah. But most people, even Dwayne never said, my dad beat me. He never punched me. But yes, it was.
But also.
It was too much.
That was likely a home where love was sparing.
Love was not non-existent, but it was very sparing.
Yeah, that was pretty common because we were still not allowed to show emotion.
Right.
So
there was a lot of embarrassment and things like that for him. And a part of Pope became so disenfranchised with life that an attachment to a hurtful, hateful reality developed along with a compulsion for murder or suicide. Dwayne expected someone would realize and discover his plan and tell him not to do it, to get him help. As with most things in his life, someone else was always there to push the decisions along. Dwayne either lost or never fully developed logical, sequential cause and effect thinking. The finality of all this came with the pressure of graduation, and with that, a closing in on the compulsory visions of murder. From a modern viewpoint, knowing what we do now about schizophrenia, a progressive disease, Dwayne Pope was not schizophrenic, but he was undoubtedly not well. At least one of the experts who testified at trial in a later interview said he feels strongly Pope was a victim of sexual abuse, likely by a male, an emasculating destruction of self-worth that festered into the compulsion toward violence. If it were just a matter of overbearing, terrible parents, that issue would have gone away when he moved to college.
Well, not necessarily.
It would have mostly gone away and would have been solvable. But he kept coming back home to the people he loved in spite of having visions to kill them. Returning to the point of trauma is very common in these instances. The other key point of note was head trauma Dwayne Pope sustained as a child. He suffered head trauma at a baseball practice when he got too close to the coach who was swinging and the bat came around full force and caught Dwayne straight on the forehead, knocking him out cold. There is a real possibility his prefrontal cortex was damaged.
You're heckin' right it was.
Our cortex is designed to moderate behavior. It's kind of like the quality assurance department of our brain that generally prohibits us from doing terrible, violent, socially unacceptable things.
It helps us read a room, basically. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, boy.
Pope's breakdown, many feel, was treatable, completely preventable. But this kid didn't know how to get help, and nobody saw the signs of inner turmoil that plagued him. In 1965, you didn't talk about suicidal thoughts or difficult feelings.
It's just, we ignored them.
Oh, entirely.
Yeah.
Not one person in his life did he ever tell all like these terrible, he told the one girlfriend, oh, I had a dream I was getting shot
right,
or I had a dream I was killing somebody.
That's a dream.
That's
right?
Not saying, like, hey, yeah, it's.
I'm having these thoughts all the time.
No.
You know? Oh gosh.
Few who've studied this case resolve themselves to believing Dwayne Pope was motivated to robbery by greed.
Right.
Sadly, it was in fact an irresistible but controllable compulsion for murder that slowly manifested over decades, which motivated Dwayne Pope into robbery. There's a couple last points I'm gonna bring up here, but there was just a line from the book that was one of the key sources for this called Anyone But Dwayne, and I have to share the closing thoughts of this because I think they're so relevant. Quote, this is from Anyone But Dwayne. It reminds us that our every action toward others, however innocent, may be the speck that tips a teetering psyche into the depths of despair. I ended my study of a killer's life with the realization that we are all tillers of humanity, and with the conviction that good parenting remains the most important job in the world.
Whoa. That was something that we didn't understand in 1965. Let's face it, in the 90s, how many cases have we covered that
we weren't getting it then?
We still, yeah. And so many people will say that our kids are getting soft and all that stuff. No, I hope, it's my opinion, that we're becoming better parents and we're nurturing our kids more than we ever had, than we ever got.
Yeah.
Ooh, that one hits me. Oof.
That line that we are all tillers of humanity?
Yeah.
Is like one of the most powerful things I've ever read. So Dwayne Pope is currently incarcerated in Nebraska. He served time in Oklahoma, Texas, and Washington before finally arriving in Nebraska to finish the remainder of his life sentences. Wardens at every institution have said he is an exemplary prisoner. One even went so far as to say his job would be easier if he had more inmates like Dwayne Pope.
That's the second time someone has said that about Dwayne Pope.
Yeah. From 1978 to 1983, while incarcerated, Pope was married to college girlfriend Ramona Lowe.
look, there is emotion here over Dwayne Pope's life. That is not to belittle or take away from the lives that he took at all.
No.
I think it is showing where we have gone wrong in society and parenting and all of those things. Those three lives should not have been taken, and no. And Franklin should not have been injured.
No,
it's not black and white here. There is a very, very big gray area, and it's okay to feel feelings for both sides, especially in a case like this.
Yeah, I do agree. And I think the biggest point and the reason to me it was important to go into Dwayne's psyche is just that because it was preventable, and anybody can say, well, all murder is preventable. Different. There's a nuance here.
This was
a kid who was tormented and needed help and didn't know how to get it. And everybody said, even if his brain was damaged, his brain was traumatized, even psychologists say with the right circumstance and environment, you can still develop those habits if you are trained into it.
Right. And also his parents probably wouldn't have known what to do with him.
No.
If he had come to them or gone to them and said, you know, hey, I'm having these thoughts, his parents likely wouldn't have known what to do.
Well, and he felt that people didn't care about him.
Yeah.
And they did. Yeah. And even his best friend, Petrucci, who was his co-captain in football and his roommate in college, Petrucci has bared guilt his whole life because he was his best friend that ribbed his buddy. Yeah. It was normal. You ribbed your buddies. You give your friend shit. He didn't know that giving
that
his buddy.
Him in that
yes.
Way.
Yes. That was, yeah. it was, and it all came out, and, it's just really tough. It's really tough. No, there's more sadness than anything for the victims who lost their lives here. But through that, we just hope to have more understanding. And again, we've said it before, when we know better, we do better. Mm-hmm. I found this couple last points of note here. In 2021, Pope's getaway vehicle, the 1965 Chevy Impala, sold at auction to an undisclosed buyer for the price of $45,000. It had 13,962 miles and was previously held at a Nebraska museum. The purchase included other memorabilia related to the incident.
God, it feels so weird.
Franklin Kjeldgaard went on to become president of Farmer State Bank, eventually retiring in 2004. Even more importantly, Frank became a civic leader and strong advocating voice for disabled rights.
Oh, wow. Wow.
He spearheaded an effort for the passage of LB 602 in 1977. The law required public buildings in Nebraska to be designed so they can be entered by handicapped persons. And he actually led by example by being the first one to change his own bank,
yeah.
Kjeldgaard hoped to see that become federal law.
Wow.
Which, of course, we know he eventually did.
Yeah.
He passed away peacefully in 2012.
Oh, man. What a... Oof. Wow.
Sources for this one. Dwayne Earl Pope versus the United States of America. The book, Anyone But Dwayne by Noel Grove. Newspaper story in Enterprise Record with contributing UPI writers William Brinton, James R. Quinn, and David Smothers. Omaha World Herald story by James Denny. The McPherson College Spectator article by Adriel Harvey. AutoEvolution.com, JulesbergAdvocate.com, PopCenter.ASU.edu, The Timeline from ThePeopleOfHistory.com, InfoPlease.com, and The Atlantic. Midwest Murder is co-hosted by Joan Alanto and Don Palumbo. Please do check out our socials for merch and tour dates, which are coming right up. Thank you so much.